executive session.
And I'm opening a public hearing on House Bill 5026, Department of Human Services. Today is Monday, February 16th, Joint Committee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services. Hello, everybody. We have one major presentation with a joint panel. Will everybody be coming up at the same time for this one? Thank you. Ms. Byerly, will you start us off, please?
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, so as you know, we are in the process of hearing from the Department of Human Services on various programs. Last week, we heard about the Aging and People with Disabilities programs. Later this week, we're going to hear more about the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Program. Today, it's a joint presentation on two or three large issues that are shared by both Aging and People with Disabilities and the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities Program. So they're going to kind of provide you a joint presentation on some big topics as a segue into our next few days of public hearing.
Thank you. Mr. McCormick.
Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having us here this morning. For the record, my name is Mike McCormick, and I'm the Director for the Aging and People with Disabilities Program within the Department of Human Services. To my right.
For the record, my name is Lilia Tennanty. I'm the Director of the Office of Developmental Disabilities Services.
For the record, my name is Tamara Brickman, and I'm with the Department of Administrative Services Chief Financial Office.
All right. Good morning, Representative Nathanson and committee. Today we're here to talk about a number of different things, or a couple of very significant federal regulations that will have an impact, and already to some extent having an impact on both DD and APD, long-term supports and services programs within the Department of Human Services. Oregon's APD and DD programs have a long history and a proud history of serving people to live independently in their own homes and communities. Together, APD and DD serve over 44,000 people in the community through a number of different programs. Some of her you've heard about from Mike and his presentations earlier. Others are DD programs, but basically the larger categories are foster care homes, group homes. We have a lot of people in home supports, assisted living, employment services, and day services. And so what we're going to be talking about today, the regulations have an impact, if not on all of these different programs and the people served in them, on some of them. And so that's what we wanted to share with you. Specifically, these are federal regulations that have come down in the past year from two different parts of the federal government, which is always interesting. The first one is from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They issued regulations on home and community-based services on January 16th of 2014. The other regulation that Mike is going to be talking in detail about is a U.S. Department of Labor regulation that really talks to and speaks to changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act. Both of these regulations together have an impact on our programs, and we have been approaching them together in a joint way to try to address the changes that will occur as a result of these regulations. It's important to note that with both of these regulations, we've had very significant stakeholder engagement and involvement in the process. We've had our community-based providers represented. We've had advocates represented in these meetings, people that we serve, consumers, and also our state and local employee entities that are involved in these programs. I'm going to be talking first about the home and community-based settings regulations. CMS initiated, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services initiated home and community-based settings and services as an option for people instead of going into institutional settings in the 1980s. Since then, the program has grown significantly nationally and in Oregon as well. For the first time, what occurred in, What occurred for the first time with this release of the regulation in January 2014 is that CMS really laid out what their expectations are for these home and community-based settings. They've operated for many years under particular guidance that didn't have a lot of definition or clarity around what they expected a home and community-based setting to look like. And so this regulation, for the first time really, from CMS, defines what they expect a home and community-based setting to look like. in the context of this particular regulation, it impacts all community-based services, not just DD and APD. We should also mention mental health has home and community-based programs that are also impacted by this particular regulation. And then through all of those, where OHA has been involved in our discussions as well. It establishes a timeline for states to indicate how they're going to implement programs and policies and procedures to come into compliance with the regulation. It creates new protections for people served in these settings, and it really establishes provider requirements for community-based care providers. So it lays out what we expect settings to be like for the people, both for the individuals themselves, so they have a voice in what's happening, and also for the provider community. In the regulation, CMS states very clearly, and I think this is, you know, pretty well understood in the community, in the long-term supports and services community, that there are settings that are not considered home and community-based, and these would be hospitals, nursing facilities, and we have here listed IMDs. These are service elements and settings that CMS considers to be institutional, and they're very clear in this regulation that they are separate from what they consider home and community-based settings. The list of settings on the right-hand side of the slide, settings that must be reviewed, these are settings that we generally consider to be home and community-based. I think for Oregon, a lot of these settings already meet the requirements, but as part of the implementation plan, CMS is going to expecting states to really go out and do an assessment and review these settings and make sure that they meet the new expectations in the federal regulation. There's also an expectation that there will be some settings that require a heightened level of scrutiny, both from the state and CMS, and basically those are settings that they say homes that may be on the grounds of or adjacent to institutional settings.
Madam Chair?
Yeah.
Yes.
Quick question, if I may. Maybe you're going to get here, because I haven't read ahead, but do you have a sense of how many people in Oregon are currently in facilities are currently in facilities that are not considered community-based? Like, what percentage and what's the number?
For the intellectual and developmental disability service system, we serve everyone in home and community-based settings. We have no one in institutional settings.
Thanks.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, in the Aging and People with Disabilities program, it's around 4,500 that are not community-based.
Out of how many total?
Around 31,000 individuals.
Mm. So
okay.
Majority are community.
Yeah, and quick follow-up with me, Madam Chair. So just to clarify, HCBS isn't saying that if someone needs services, especially in the aging and people with disabilities arena, Mr. McCormick, if somebody has needs that the skill set can't be met in a community setting, they don't have to be migrated out of there are people you really couldn't serve in a community setting in this context. Am I not correct?
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Steiner Hayward, correct. Everyone will still be able to get their needs met in the setting that's most appropriate to them. The big why around the committee cares about the home and community-based service regulations is because CMS is saying that as of a certain point of time, federal matching funds will not be available for home and community-based services if you're serving individuals in a setting that is not compliant. So it's really a federal funding issue ultimately for why we've raised this issue to the Ways and Means Subcommittee.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you. Really, from the CMS perspective with these regulations, the expectation is that services be provided in settings that are integrated in and support full access to the community for everyone who is receiving services. Fortunately, and I really think, again, pointing to Oregon's leadership in transitioning and moving people into community-based settings, the goals that are laid out in these regulations are consistent with the goals of APD and DD in terms of what we want for people who live in our long-term supports and services in the community. We want a person to live, work, and spend the day in settings that are integrated. We want the individual to be able to select from among a variety of available options. We want the rights of privacy, dignity, and respect to be upheld and ensure the individual is free from coercion and restraint. And the individual has autonomy and independence in making life decisions, and the individual has choice regarding services and who provides them. These are core components of this regulation and really in a lot of ways consistent with how we approach our service systems to begin with.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm trying to, I'm sitting here and I've been on this for a long time. I'm trying to figure out what's new as you do this, because some of the things that you're talking about, particularly some of the principles, have been principles that have been placed for a long time. It started way back, probably before you were born, with People's First. Yes. So I'm trying to wrap my arms around what's new that's come out from CMS and what have you, and what really that's so new that will change the paradigm in where Oregon has been headed in the first place. So
Co-chair,
get there.
Excuse me, Co-Chair Nathan and committee, I think that what's new is that CMS is really putting this out in regulation for the first time. This has been the goal of CMS over time, and Oregon has definitely been a leader in heading in this direction. Maybe the next piece, this next slide, will kind of give some more details of what's expected for individuals in this regulation. So in terms of what's new, I'll go back to CMS has actually now put this in a regulation for the first time in a way that they haven't before. And so they really haven't, in other states where this may have been an issue, they haven't had any kind of way to prevent things from being considered home and community-based that really weren't. And so in Oregon, because we're ahead of the curve in this environment, some of this does feel like it's not new. I think to go to Mike's point, they are now tying a federal funding expectation to it, and so we are putting together a plan to ensure that we can demonstrate that all of our settings meet these compliance, meet these regulations, and for some that don't, and there may be some that don't, put together a timeline and a plan so that they can meet compliance and they can come into compliance and we aren't at risk with our federal funding. So in terms of what's new, too, I would say these very specific, on the next slide, improvements for individuals and what individuals can expect. And we want to work with the people, consumers, and our self-advocates who are being served in these settings. The individual will have a lease or other legally enforceable agreement providing tenant protections. I can say that we do have some individuals that have that right now in their provider settings, but then we do have some that don't. And this will be something new that providers are going to have to work through and work with the state and the individuals they serve to develop. The individual has privacy in his or her unit, including lockable doors, choice of roommates, and freedom to furnish or decorate the unit. Again, we've got some providers that are well moving in this direction, are already there. We've got others that we're going to have some program and policy changes probably to get us here. The individual controls his or own schedule, including access to food at any time. The individual can have visitors at any time, and the setting is physically accessible. So these are all requirements in the regulation around protections for the individual that CMS really hasn't laid out for the state before.
Madam Chair, I'm curious, has there been a problem? Has this been a problem? I mean, that's a lot of stuff right there that causes me to walk away saying there's a problem. And I've just not seen that. I mean, when I've gone around and visited folks.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that for the most part, these aren't issues, these aren't challenges. I think that, again, this is a federal regulation. They're not just looking at Oregon. They're looking at every state. And I can say very clearly, there are states that this is going to be a significant challenge for. They don't operate like this. They don't understand what it means for a person to have control over their setting. And so what we're sharing here is what CMS is saying and how it's consistent with where we want to go. We're also saying, though, as part of this program and effort, is it's not just a clear, we can't just say, check, we're done, CMS, thank you very much. We now have to go through the steps of demonstrating that every setting that we have, whether it be APD, DD, or mental health, meets these requirements. And if when I can say from the DD perspective, we do have some settings because we serve people with significant needs who are ultimately potentially a danger to themselves or others. There are some additional requirements we're going to have to meet to continue the federal funding for those settings to be home and community-based, because they may not meet all of these requirements because we're serving people in these home and community-based settings who may be a risk. And so it's going through a series of steps. Yes, in general, absolutely. I'm sure you've been out to many provider settings, and you've seen that the environments are what we want them to be, exactly. And so for those agencies and those settings, this is just going to be something that we all go through. But through this process, we'll be demonstrating to CMS that we're meeting the requirements in the regulation, and then ultimately addressing potentially those settings where that may not be the case.
Just, I got to follow up on this, Madam Chair. So do we ever have anybody as a representative from the state of Oregon going back to Washington, D.C. with the feds to try to kind of have some positive and common sense input into their decision-making process coming down like this, knowing that we're ahead of the game?
Representative Nathanson and committee, I would say absolutely. Mike and myself, through our national organizations, are in pretty much regular contact with folks at CMS. I also say through our work on a day-to-day basis, we talk to the people at CMS both regionally and at the federal level. So those engagements are occurring at least with us, and I'm sure in other ways as well, with our advocates.
Oh my gosh.
Madam Chair, is it fair to say that really what we're talking about is that for you to upgrade and to come out with a timetable and standards so that you can meet with the providers to make certain that they're in compliance? Because honestly, you know, we're sitting here, we're puzzled and perplexed. Oregon has been doing this as long as I've been a legislator. Mm-hmm. Even before I was a legislator, when we started with People's First. So we're trying to wrap our arms around. So if it's something that the agency itself is going to need to work with providers, that's a whole different discussion. But honestly, I don't want to put it that it's only because of CMS. You know, if it's the right thing for us to do, then that's for us to do, regardless of CMS. And we have been on the cutting edge of this for years when we decided to actually eliminate Fairview and to integrate individuals into our communities. So, you know, for me, it's like setting up and saying it's something that the agency now needs to get their act together to make certain things are in compliance so that we don't run the risk of funding. So is that where you're at?
Representative Nathanson and Senator Winters, yeah, that's what this guidance does, is it tells the state that we have to assure these things. And we have wanted these things to happen. We know providers have been doing it, but now it's part of our compliance efforts with CMS. And if you turn, we go to the next slide, you're ahead of where we talk about the transition plan. This is what's in the regulations. Yeah.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Can we just go back to the other slide for 1 second?
The slides numbered?
Apparently not.
No.
I'm just. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just really puzzled by this. And I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking if I were somebody who ran an adult foster home, for example, where a lot of these clients are living in really good places, and I've been to a lot of these as a physician as well as a legislator and as a friend of people living there, I'm not sure I'd want to stay in this business anymore. And I have to wonder whether, I mean, I think, for example, about people with mild to moderate dementia who have been living in that same foster home for a while, have had cognitive decline, but because they're in a familiar environment can stay there, but don't really get the prospect that locking their door so nobody can get in to help them is a bad idea, right? And I think about safety issues, and I think about the visitors at any time. Okay, fine, but I also know people who have lived, let's say, alternative lifestyles, who really would prefer to have their visitors, and a lot of people be visiting them, would be 1 o'clock in the morning. And a lot of the providers are living in the same homes as their clients. And I'm not totally convinced that I would want to be doing this anymore as a business.
I have it's something I'd like to interject here for a moment. There's obviously going to be a lot of policy implications about this. When I think about it from a ways and means perspective, I'd like to know the degree to which Oregon is out of compliance, that we have problems being reported. How does that compare to all the other states, how the degree to which they are in or out of compliance, and what kind of resources it's going to take us to address this? And does that further delay other important things that we already had on our to-do list?
We'll go to Chair Nathanson and committee. Thank you. These are all very good questions and comments, and I can say absolutely these are the kinds of discussions we've been having in our stakeholder groups. In terms of the transition plan and the fiscal impact and those types of things, what CMS expects each state to do is to submit a transition plan that documents when they're going to be able to demonstrate that they're in full compliance, and it has to be within 5 years of the effective date of the rule. So March 17, 2019 is the date, as Mike mentioned, when if we can't demonstrate that settings are in full compliance, that's the point at which the Medicaid funding issue comes into play. We have submitted our first draft of the statewide transition plan, and in that, it calls for a provider assessment. We'll be working with providers. We have an assessment tool that we'll be working with providers, and they'll be completing and returning back to us. We also, as that part of that process, are doing a survey with the consumers and the people that we're serving directly, so they can indicate to us the extent to which that they feel their settings meet these requirements and expectations. Then within that, there's an expectation that the state verify what they're hearing or what they read or get back in the provider surveys. We'll be using our regular licensing and regulatory office to do those types of visits, as well as other avenues that we have available to us when we go out in the community. We've submitted our statewide transition plan to CMS. I will say, again, we were one of the first states to submit their statewide transition plan. And at the time of this slide, we were awaiting further feedback from CMS, but this slide was done a week ago. And so we have received further feedback from CMS, and it's very positive. And in general, they've asked for more detail on a number of different points within the plan. But we continue to work with them, and we'll be submitting that back to them for their approval as expected in the regulation. The financial implications, I think, over the next, as we work through the transition time plan, the transition timeline, the financial implications beyond just that drop dead or that deadline of March 2019, when Medicaid may be implicated, it may be removed from settings that don't meet compliance. As we get the consumer and provider surveys in, as we get the provider plans, that's when we'll know information about what types of additional funding and the implications that from a funding perspective might occur with providers. Because if you read, again, the regulation and the expectations, there are some things that are probably going to have cost with our provider community, and we want to be aware of that and cognizant of that as we move forward. Things like, you know, as you've mentioned, locks on doors and the keys for, you know, individuals and appropriate staff and those types of things. So at this point...
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Has anyone said to, and I'm going to follow up on, Chair Nathanson, follow up on Andy's, Representative Olson's conversation, the cost ultimately will be borne by the states. I mean, let's be very clear of what's going on, whatever changes or modification are budgetary implications. And Representative Olson brought up a very key point of who's doing what with on the national level to say that some of this stuff may or may not be able to happen within the boundaries of a state. So I don't know who, you know, is doing that. You're saying their CMS regulations, and they can be changed actually nationally by legislation. And is anyone taking the lead, states collectively, to challenge some of these issues? Two, a part of this, and I don't know whether, and I'll direct this to you, Mike, when we talk institutions, whether our state group homes also fall into these categories or not, and if they too would have some of the same regulatory requirements, such as the locked door issues and some of those, and where we're already having some very serious problems within those particular environments, to where we have staff that repeatedly are having to have worker comp injury because of the combativeness and violence in there. So help me with that one as well. So is that saying that you're no longer going to have the same kind of policies governing some of those institutions and group homes?
Actually,
I think Representative Nathanson, Chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, you're referring to the Stabilization and Crisis Unit that's actually managed by the Office of Developmental Disability Services. And yes, as part of this process, those are considered based on how we fund them as home and community-based settings. And so they will be part of this process, and the expectation is, like provider agencies that serve people with significant need, that they will go through what is called in the regulation a heightened scrutiny process, and will have to demonstrate that the restrictions that are in place for each individual, and we know why they're in place, and that the person the person's needs are being met with those restrictions.
Is the feds trying to get states not to do business anymore?
Chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, I can. There has been. I'd be happy to produce.
I'm serious.
Yeah, no, it's a very legitimate question. In some state, that has been a very directed question to CMS. I will say, if it's helpful to have, we can provide all of the public comment that was submitted to CMS for these rules and regulations. You will see some very extensive comments along the lines that you are making now in hearing about these regulations for the first time. So there's been extensive debate. I will say, even after, as an example, even after the regulations came out, CMS very quickly came out with guidance on 24-hour, came out with guidance on residential settings. And if you read the requirements I went through earlier, they really do kind of appropriately, they fall within the residential requirement idea of access to food, visitors, doors, and being able to choose a roommate. CMS really, in some ways, toward the end of the process, announced that these regulations would also apply to day service settings. So like day programs, both through APD and DD, employment settings, those types of things. And as an example of the back and forth at a federal level that's occurred, the guidance on those settings didn't come out until well late in the year. And when it did come out, it was really, I would say, kind of vague and broad. It said basically, based on everything, that the people have to have access to the community, and it didn't provide a lot of guidance like they had on the residential side. So there has been, I would say, from our perspective, a great deal of debate at the federal level, but ultimately the regulations are in effect.
Follow up, given the political change in Washington, D.C., at the congressional and Senate level, there may be some opportunities to actually have some input and some influence on this direction. I mean, some of this makes sense, but some of this is not common sense. And it's that not common sense that I think is giving us pause. And so just to say that it is what it is, I don't think is where this body sits. At least this one's not.
Nope.
Madam Chair, I'm curious, what is the figure we're looking at, the dollar amount that we're looking at from the feds for their investment in us for compliance of this?
Chair Nathanson, committee, at this point, the federal match for anything related to this will be consistent with what it is now for all Medicaid programs. There isn't any additional funding at this point that's tied to this for states, so it is in some ways an unfunded mandate. States, I'm sure, as Oregon will be doing, we're looking at, you know, how as we get the information back from providers and we look at our provider surveys and we figure out exactly what the full implications of this are going to be, we'll be looking at those kinds of issues in the context of our rates and how we fund providers.
And
go ahead.
Representative Olson, I'll get right back to you. Thus, one of the questions I asked earlier, since we've had to insert this, we, meaning you, have had to insert this in your agency's work program, and it was not anticipated, to what extent will this delay other things that we already knew we did want to work on? Because we have to make room now for this, which takes time and resources.
That's a good point, too.
Chair Nathanson, that is an excellent question and point. This is taking a considerable amount of resource. I'll speak to the DD system, and then I'll let Mike speak to the APD system. For the DD system, as you'll hear in the program overview tomorrow, over the last biennium, we have undergone a great deal of change and continue to try to work through and implement our programs consistent with the Community First Choice, or K plan, and so that's taking a considerable effort for us. And so what these regulations do is just it's like an added expectation on top of everything else we're already working on. And I don't know, Mike, if you've got some specific examples for APD.
Madam Co-Chair, APD has been able to absorb this workload with its current staffing level. I'm sure that certain things have become delayed as a result of our work on this, but I don't have specific examples for you today.
Thank you. I am noting that you're not quite half done with what you do Absolutely. Want to get through today.
We are. This concludes, although I expect based on this we'll have further discussion. We're happy to engage in further discussion. The presentation of these regulations and the intent of this was, as I said at the beginning, just to kind of share this information with you so you have an understanding of regulations that are having an impact on both APD and DD, and in this case the mental health system as well. And we look forward to continuing to discuss these issues with you, and we'll update you on the work of the stakeholder group and our transition plan and our negotiations with CMS as we go forward. And with that, I will turn it over to Mike to talk about the Department of Labor.
Okay, so several of you thought
the last conversation was going to be
wait
easy.
This one.
Now that everybody's awake.
Yes. I'm here to discuss the changes to the Fair Labor Standards Act regulations promulgated by the Department of Labor with you this morning. So October 1st, 2013, they issued final rules that extended overtime protections and minimum wage protections to home care workers. These include personal support workers in the developmental disabilities programs. And it also has a very minimal impact in Oregon Health Authority. Their Addictions and Mental Health program operates a very small personal care program that is impacted by these rules, but the impact, you know, the fiscal impact is really in DHS. I mean, their fiscal impact is truly immaterial to the overall fiscal impact of these regulations. So the topics they undertook were changes about overtime and minimum wage calculations for hourly providers, live-in providers. These are workers that live in the consumer's own home and receive compensation for performing activities of daily living. Travel time between consumers, which I'll illustrate for you later in the presentation. Also, new additional record-keeping requirements. I'm going to walk through all of these changes for you through this presentation. Now, this is why we're here today. Overlaying the proposed Department of Labor requirements over our existing system without programmatic modifications has a biennial fiscal impact of approximately $74 million general fund, $242 million total fund. It's a big, big issue, and we've been engaging in this issue intensely for over a year. So why did the Department of Labor make these changes? I've had lots of discussions with Department of Labor. I've participated in their conference calls. I've heard them present on this issue. And basically what they're after is consistent interpretation of the Fair Labor Standards Act for this group of workers. provides minimum wage protections to this group of workers, which is one of the very few areas in federal law that does not have that protection. They've seen the demographics that are coming, and they said we need to professionalize this workforce and, you know, treat them as if any, just like any other employee, so that there is a strong labor market to serve that population. They've also consistently noted the workforce participation profile, which is 90% women and 50% minority. And I'm not going to sugarcoat this, but in areas of this country, there are some probably unscrupulous practices towards the employees of in-home agencies. So this isn't just a state issue. This is also around the in-home agencies in all 50 states that employ workers that go into people's homes and provide assistance with activities of daily living. So we have not been unscrupulous. We actually have valued this workforce greatly in Oregon. I think it was 99 when the home care workers first received their rights to collectively bargain with the state. Today, under the collective bargaining agreement, they're getting $13.75 to $14.75 per hour. And for context, the federal poverty level for a family of four is $23,800. At this rate of $13.75 full-time, that's an annual salary of $28,000. So it is, we did lift this workforce out of the poverty levels in the last collective bargaining session. The one area where we do not pay minimum wage still is we pay $6.88 for what we call standby care and also assistance with something called instrumental activities of daily living. So if you can think about live-in providers, they live with the consumer and they are on call on basically a 24/7 basis. Some of those hours are compensated at this rate of $6.88 per hour. Some of the other things like housekeeping, it's $6.88, and I think the rationale for that was both the consumer and the home care worker benefits from that service of housekeeping, cooking, those types of activities, you know, to support that policy. We also are providing insurance for the vast, vast majority of home care workers and personal support workers that participate. They have recently received paid time off. They get training. We cover them all with workers' comp, and they're all subject to unemployment. So when a consumer, you know, if they're serving a consumer in their own home and the consumer's health deteriorates and they end up in a nursing facility, the home care worker ultimately becomes eligible for unemployment compensation.
Can I ask for, yes, Madam Chair, just clarification. So it's $6.88 if they do housekeeping. Could you clarify that piece and what exactly standby means?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer, yes. So there are activities of daily living. These include things like bathing, actual assistance with eating. I'm going blank.
Toileting, bathing, dressing.
Thank you. Toileting. Instrumental activities of daily living are things that help keep a person actually independent. So you can't live in your own home if you don't have assistance with cooking or assistance with housekeeping. Those types of tasks are compensated at $6.88 per hour for live-ins only. And live-ins make up about, I think it's approximately 10% of APD's total in-home caseload. Those hours are compensated as that, in addition to hours where you're on standby. So you're sitting with the consumer, you're watching TV maybe for an hour, and then the consumer says, I need to use the restroom, and then, you know, that takes 15 minutes. The whole hour, that first hour, would be considered standby time. They're kind of like engaged to work. And the 15 minutes would be providing direct service at the $13.75 per hour. So that's kind of the system in a nutshell.
So any of that housekeeping, serving, bathing, is the regular hourly wage?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Kenny Geyer, not bathing. Bathing is an activity of daily living, so that would be included at the wage rate of $13.75.
That's what she just said.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. But not the instrumental activities of daily living would be at the lower rate. I'm sorry.
We have several people who've requested time to ask questions and make comments. I hope that you're able to bring us additional information at a later time. I'd like to see how many hours a day the typical person live in is compensated at the, let's say, the $14 rate, and how many hours usually are compensated at the other rate. Is it like a half hour or 6 hours? If you could show us that would help. Representative Boone and then Representative Stark.
I'm just curious, I guess, how, if you're a live-in provider, how do you have a little notebook you carry around and you break it down as to how many hours and what you're doing and as to what you get paid for? How's that?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone, there is an expectation that both the consumer and the provider are keeping track of those hours. At the state level, we only see those hours aggregated on either a two-week basis or a monthly basis. That's what we receive for authorization for payment. Both parties attest that those hours were worked. Now, this regulation does have additional timekeeping requirements where we're going to have, in my example that I just gave, 9 to 10 this type of activity, 10 to 10:15 this type of activity. We will need to be moving towards that kind of detailed system.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So I just want to clarify what I think is an assumption here for, you know, the 688 standby for live-in providers. Is the assumption is that room and board is provided as part of their wages, and therefore the hourly is less? Is that correct?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Stark, yes. The provider or home care worker or personal support worker does not pay a room and board fee to the consumer who's receiving the in-home services. So they are, in effect, receiving free room, and I'm sure there are varied practices about the amount of board that's contained in that.
Great
question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mike, so you mentioned that 10% of the APD's caseload is this environment. What's that mean to me? I mean, how many people is that?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, approximately 10% of our in-home population on the APD side only is live-in. The other 90% are receiving services on an hourly basis, so the home care worker lives in their own home. They come in the morning and provide services for a few hours and then go back home. So on the APD system, I'm rounding these numbers, but it's approximately 14,000 total individuals we're serving, and approximately 1,500 are in the live-in program.
Yes, Madam Chair. What percentage of the live-in are family members?
Yes.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Senator Winters, I do not know the answer to that question, and I don't believe that we capture information on whether someone is a family member.
I think it's of particular interest since you say that there is this free room and board and what have you. What percentage, if you don't capture it, perhaps that you should be capturing that information of what percentage of it is that the provider is actually a family member rather than, you know, a non-family member. So
I agree. That would be, I will make note of a need to capture that information in the future.
Yeah, that would be very helpful.
Okay. Madam Chair, so Mike, again, I'll go back to kind of an earlier question for you. I'm trying to get a handle on this. So you go back as a group from Oregon representing us to the federal government, just trying to craft or at least have some input as to where the feds are going to come up with these rules for everybody else to have to follow. When you compare notes with other states, where are we? I've always kind of thought that we were really out front. I mean, as deeply as I've been involved in Department of Human Services and the committee over the last 8 years and everything, I've always thought that we were pretty good on what we're doing. And right now, I mean, I'm getting a picture painted from what the feds are it's like we don't count. I don't know. I'm struggling with this, be truthful with you.
Yeah.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, this is a very tough issue. I can tell you that the department issued comments on the regulations. When the regulations were ultimately finalized, we quickly initiated one-on-one discussions with the Department of Labor. The state made a request for one of three things to happen because Oregon's system is so much different than a lot of other states. We asked for either an 18-month delay in the enforcement of the regulations, an 18-month delay in the regulations themselves, or a waiver for states such as Oregon that have pretty progressive compensation systems for these this group of employees. The Department of Labor took those concerns seriously, and they ultimately granted a 6-month enforcement moratorium in response to, I think it was primarily Oregon's request. They also granted an additional 6 months of period of time where they're going to consider how states are coming into compliance. If you're making good faith efforts, they're probably not going to come after the states. And I've also engaged quite intensively with our national association on this issue, and they have lobbied on our behalf as well around this issue. I mean, it is a very tough issue that disproportionately affects states like Oregon that have really progressive home and community-based service systems.
I'd like to be sure that we get through the presentation. I have looked through some of the slides that are coming next, and these topics will be repeated, and we will have additional opportunity to discuss them.
Yeah, but I might forget that.
Madam Chair, can
yes,
I have
Senator
a question
Winters.
For him to bring the information back? I think
yes.
It's in line. And that's one, how many states... and I think we were probably one of the first to start having home care workers. So how many states out of the 50 do have, number one? And number two, how many of the states actually do the bargaining, the compensatory bargaining stuff for the workers? So if you can bring that information back, because I know we were on the cutting edge in 99 when we started doing this. And so it kind of looks like, you know, again, that Oregon actually comes up with, you know, with cutting edge progressive kinds of programs, and then to later be on the penalty block by the feds. So I'd like to have that. And then I'd like to know, you said that the National Association has been, you know, kind of your lobbying arm. How much interaction have you had with our own congressional delegation on this particular issue, particularly since, you know, we do have some individuals who are both appropriation and now that's heading some of the leadership roles back in Congress?
Thank you.
If you could bring that back, I'd appreciate it.
I would be happy to. So this slide attempts to describe why we are in the middle of this issue. So in both the APD system and the DD system, consumers hire their employees directly. So I say, I want to hire Lilia. I want her to work Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 9 until noon. And that is strictly my responsibility as a consumer. Well, there's case law which says that because the state establishes pay rates, there's this whole series of tests called the economics reality test that you have to determine whether the state of Oregon is a joint employer over the what I just gave as that relationship over myself. And we asked the question of Department of Labor, and they confirmed that we are a joint employer for all of these consumers that have these direct one-on-one employment relationships with their consumers. And my presentation is going to illustrate how that affects us. So let's take this example. Three different consumers utilize the same home care worker in a week. For each of them, they work 15 hours. There's no overtime liability scenario in that one-to-one relationship. But because the state has been determined the joint employer over all three of those consumers, there is a five-hour overtime liability for this situation. So as you can tell, this is problematic because the state does not tell consumers at this point, you know, you can hire this person, but only if they work this many hours of week per week. So we're kind of under the existing programmatic framework, we will ultimately be liable for this 5 hours of overtime and potentially more with a lot of scenarios that are occurring.
Maybe I'm missing something. Yeah. It's 5 hours overtime because it's over 40 hours. But in the illustration, it's three different mm-hmm. workers. You're talking about one worker working part-time for three different individuals.
Correct, Representative Nathanson. One home care worker working for three different consumers, 15, 15, 15, 45 hours in a week. And because the regulation says overtime must be paid for hours worked over 40 a week, we are subject to a five-hour overtime liability in this example.
The example just showed three different home care workers, so I just wanted to clarify that's the case. Representative Boone.
Thank you. And I'm getting a little bit confused too. So if an in-home or a live-in care worker is someone who comes, you know, like you come and take care of me 24/7. What if I have a daughter or a son who does that, lives there? Do they get paid too? And how is that vetted and how does that work?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone, for a live-in, you actually have a bedroom in the consumer's home. You live there, that's your place of residence. In some instances, there are family members that are living there and serving as a live-in mm-hmm. home care worker. There are other examples where a family member could live in the home but not be deemed a live-in home care worker. These are scenarios where I like to use the illustration of the funnel. So we have individuals that can have access to our long-term services and support system, but we have restricted those individuals that qualify for live-in services because it's a higher cost, higher expectations, and so in that example, they may or may not be a live-in provider.
Representative,
I'm sorry, can I follow up? What's the vetting process then?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone, we have this in our regulations or Oregon administrative rules, and there are things like, you know, the individual is a danger to themselves, like say they engage in wandering behavior, say someone that is dependent on a ventilator, they would be eligible. So basically it has a lot of safety concerns in our criteria for eligibility around live-in, and I can follow up with you and get the full list of criteria for who qualifies for live-in services.
Helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Mike, just following up on FSLA question, was there any discussion around the idea of what scenarios could exist that would exempt this area right here?
Through the stakeholder process?
Mm-hmm. Well, just not that, but also bringing it back to Washington, D.C.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, I don't believe so. Other states are dealing with this issue. through, say, legislation or administrative rules, where they're saying we're not going to authorize payment for workers that exceed 40 in a week. We're not at that point yet. We do have options for modifications to our programs in Oregon, and I'll be discussing that a little further along in the presentation.
So just kind of a carve-out is what you, it sounds like what other states are considering or doing.
I think they're, I wouldn't call it a carve-out. I would call it just placing a limit on hours worked in order to minimize the cost to the state.
Are we in this situation because we've been determined to be a joint employer?
Yes, Co-Chair Nathanson.
And if we were not a joint employer, this would not be the case?
Correct.
That is correct.
Representative Stewart.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. So maybe you're going to get to this, but tie it into all this. I'm seeing no way that we are able to protect, state funds from the amount of overtime that you could end up paying. So the current situation, there's nothing that would keep this individual from working 20 hours of overtime, and we're paying time and a half for all that. So how do we financially plan for that? What is the plan for that? And how do we protect ourselves from the abundance of overtime that we could have to pay?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Stark, that's exactly why we're here today, to kind of raise awareness of the issue and kind of be the first step towards engaging in the discussions about what kind of program modifications do we want to make in Oregon so as to minimize the liability associated with these regulations. And the department has done a lot of work around this, and we had a proposal, and everything has gotten significantly more complicated since that proposal was initially formulated, and I'll be discussing why that is. But yes, programmatic modifications are an option to limit the fiscal impact of this.
Okay.
So live-in program accounts for approximately 80 to 85% of the fiscal impact associated with these regulations. And why is that? Because when I live in someone's home under these regulations, and if I'm expected to meet the needs of the individuals whenever they arise, I am technically on the job at that point. And therefore, with 24 hours in a day, you incur the overtime liability on the 41st hour of the second day, and the remainder of the week would be compensated at full overtime hours. So we do have solutions to that issue that we're going to discuss, but that kind of illustrates why the fiscal impact with these regulations is so high. And so that issue alone accounts for 80, 85% of the fiscal impact. Travel time. So I tried to set up a little illustration about this. So a home care worker up here, they travel to their first consumer of the day. That's just like any of us going to work. That's going to be unpaid. But then, they provide an hour of service. Then they travel an hour to the second consumer. That hour is going to be paid, which we are not currently doing in today's system. If they go to a third consumer, half hour travel, that's going to be paid. When they ultimately travel back home, that will be unpaid, just as if we go to a work. And again, to reiterate, why is this? It's because the state has been determined a joint employer over all of these providers.
Can I ask just a fundamental question, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Can you just, because I'm getting overwhelmed, and I've been around a long time. Can you just separate out for us, when you come back in the future, those impacts that have to do with impact versus those indications that are actually traveling and roving around? That would be helpful for me. And the other thing that would be helpful for me when we start talking about budget, what happens if the impact is $94 million and we only give you $35 million?
look at the next.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Co-Chair Nathanson and Senator Winters, I do have the data on the information you're requesting and will be providing that to you. Record-keeping requirements, I addressed this. I think it was Representative Boone's questions. We're going to have to keep detailed records of time worked, in and out, all of that. And, you know, ultimately, this is probably a good thing. And so we're proceeding towards implementation of this new requirement right now. So what we did is we worked with stakeholders extensively over the last year and ultimately provided a recommendation that was incorporated into the budget. So, yeah,
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, I just got
yes.
a question. Like, going back to the record keeping thing, this is a requirement the federal government's requiring us now to do. What were you doing beforehand?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, my hope is that most of these records were already being kept, but when we received the request for payment, we were receiving the hours aggregated on a monthly or biweekly basis, and that was serving as the authorization or claim for payment. So in the future, when this is implemented, we will be receiving this level of detail so that an overtime liability can be calculated.
So follow up, anybody done any calculation what this is going to cost for the businesses as well as for our state agencies for having to track this?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Olson, we do not have a solid fiscal impact associated with the new administrative requirements.
I mean, so that gets back to the unfunded mandate kind of concept once again.
To enter this data, are we going to see a proposal, for example, to develop an entirely new software system and provide computers and access to it, maybe some sort of cloud-based record-keeping system so that people are entering data directly at each place where someone is working in a home, or everybody will be supplied with some kind of a computer or iPad or smartphone to enter this electronically, and what would it take to develop such a system? Are we looking at that, or are we looking at thousands and thousands of paper records that get delivered somewhere, and then there's a big data entry center where someone's keying it all in? What's that vision?
Co-Chair Nathanson, that's an excellent question. So, first of all, we know that even if we rolled out a completely electronic timekeeping system, not everyone is going to have the ability to access that, either because of competency in IT or lack of internet access. So what we're working towards is a hybrid system that will consist of both paper records for those providers that do not have the capability to transmit this information electronically. Now, to the system that you referenced, we recently conducted a request for information from providers nationwide that do this type of work. We received, I think, 11 responses from providers that do this, and we are in the process of crafting a request for proposals to secure this type of system. And, this will be going through the stage gate review process in consultation, with DAS and LFO, but we are not at a point yet to say what that is going to cost.
Okay, you just answered my question. So it's not including the $94 million. On top of that $94 million, we've got some other really large costs for a system that we don't even know about yet. I'm not being snarky at you, Mr. McCormick, I assure you.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Representative Boone, did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say that, these are on a fairly small basis per home. So, say, four or five people in an adult foster care, I don't know how many people can have, or someone coming in. But, like at our construction business, we have time cards, and it has the name of the job, the day of the week, how many hours, so that we know how to bill it out, at the end of the time period. And you know, there's a little bit of honor system there, but it, you know, unless it's a huge crew, but you could probably corroborate that, you know, the caregiver was there at that on that day and provided 3 hours of work or whatever. It's not that tough. I mean, but as my colleague pointed out, though, when you spread that out over 1,500 people for the live-ins and 14,000 for the total, you probably have to do something IT-ish.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Boone, I agree. All options are on the table, including those that would potentially log this information automatically using something like smartphone technology. Some of our emergency response systems have built-in tracking systems. There's a lot of options out there, and at this point, I'm not prepared to say which way we're ultimately going to end up going. I just know that it ultimately is going to need to meet this base requirement.
Okay.
So, as I stated earlier, the fiscal impact associated with overlaying the requirements on our existing system was $74 million general fund. What we did was we worked with stakeholders on a proposal that invests $35 million and makes programmatic changes as follows. Limit the number of hours that a home care worker or a personal support worker may work in a week. We don't know if the figure is going to be 50, 52, 55, 60, but everyone has agreed some type of limit is necessary. The contentious point is, what is that limit? Live-in program, I gave the funnel example before. We're talking about restricting it even further so that only individuals with the most complex needs will have access to live-in services. These people in this other category still have access to in-home services, just not on a live-in basis.
So, Representative Starr.
So, on that, I'm struggling with it. That would be the approach we would take. I'm doing the math on what you said two slides back of somebody working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is what they're actually writing on their time card because they're live-in. And so 128 of those hours are time and a half. And I can't see that the logic of dealing with that problem would be fewer people get to do that. That just seems like there's got to be a different way to work out how we pay those hours and not pay someone 7 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Stark, this is a very tough issue. Even getting to this point with stakeholders was a matter of compromise. I would characterize these recommendations as reluctant acceptance, not enthusiastic endorsement. That's the point that we're at this point. And again, part of the rationale for today's presentation was to begin engaging the legislature on those discussions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, thinking back to something you mentioned very early, Mr. McCormick, these home care workers have been represented employees for some time in Oregon. Madam Chair, I don't know what your plans are down the road, but I think it would be very helpful to hear from leaders of, you know, union representatives for those represented workers about their perspectives on this. I know that they've been part of the discussions, Mr. McCormick, but I have some questions I'd just like to be able to ask them directly. And the second point is, you know, we're talking a lot about patient-centered care in the medical setting, and it strikes me that one of the biggest advantages of live-in care is that that's very person-centered care. That's about building a relationship. That's about providing options, and especially in a context of when we know that affordable housing is so limited in our state, the fact that they get housing as a benefit that goes with this in an affordable context strikes me as, I don't understand how that gets counted into the wage calculation, because, you know, in that circumstance, maybe you turn around and you charge people rent, but that taking people out of people's homes when that's been an acceptable alternative, even if it's for only a smaller percentage of the people receiving these services, makes no sense to me whatsoever. We've got to be, as Representative Stark said, there's got to be a way to work this out. But I'm the feds are fixing, trying to fix a thing that isn't broken, and I'm pretty ticked off, to be blunt. Not with you.
I want to make sure that we allow you time to finish presenting all the concepts that you needed to make us aware of today.
Okay. Thank you, Co-Chair Nathanson. The next principle was there needs to be some kind of limit on the amount of funds that we're paying out that are attributable to travel. So think rural areas where you may have someone that's traveling, you know, 90 minutes to a consumer. There was a principle endorsed that we limit the amount of compensation that is attributable to travel time, probably around 10%. So if someone's monthly compensation is $2,000, the principle would be no more than 200 of that would be attributable to travel-related expenses.
There's a point I'd like to ask about, wondering if this has been discussed with the federal government. It's because we're a joint employer. If we were trying to design the most efficient system and manage our costs, we would design such a system where we would assign who's going to which place at which time to minimize travel time, just like UPS and FedEx have delivery route systems that they know the most efficient way to do this. But that really flies in the face of providing the most choice for the person who needs the assistance. Those two are not at all compatible, which seems to be an almost unsolvable position. How are we to try to limit the cost of travel time when we provide absolute choice to the, as you call it, the customer, the person who needs the assistance?
You couldn't have said it any better, Co-Chair Nathanson, and I don't have a response to your question.
Has the point been made with the federal government in conversations? Do you know?
Yes, there have been. This is somewhat of a divisive issue. Ironically, the disability community has, a lot of the national disability groups have lobbied the Department of Labor against this because they see that states, or their prediction was states were going to make programmatic changes that would restrict hours and ultimately threaten people with disabilities' ability to live in their own homes. While that would be a position, while they'll simultaneously take a position that they want a strong workforce that gets paid well, it's just, it's a very challenging issue for everyone involved. And then we discussed the record-keeping requirements. So now things get interesting. I forget the name of the national organization, but it's a national organization that represents primarily in-home agencies, filed a lawsuit against the Department of Labor around their authority to adopt these new regulations. And on two dates, Judge Leon vacated sections of the new regulation, which frankly made up the significant majority of the fiscal impact associated with these regulations. So some stuff survived, but the fiscal impact with the stuff survived is really not that significant. Then Department of Labor quickly followed with their own appeal of that decision. They asked for an expedited review. They were granted that request, and so it now sits with the DC Court of Appeals. Briefing scheduled to conclude by early April. Everything I'm hearing is saying that we're going to have a decision late summer, early fall on this issue. So that means the where we're at right now is in a point of great uncertainty. So what I would propose to the committee this morning is we have a well-established stakeholder group that has been working on this issue, as I said, for over a year. We have a meeting with them next week. We have not met with them since these decisions were reached. I would like, so basically, I've also engaged in discussions with the Department of Labor since they lost that decision and since they filed their appeal. Their public position is they are going to win, and they are expecting states to be working towards compliance with these new regulations. They've publicly stated that there will not be an additional delay of enforcement. We don't know if they're posturing or if what they're saying is true. The most risk-averse way to approach this is to plan accordingly, with a knowledge of all of the facts. So what I would propose to do is to discuss proposed next steps with the stakeholder community next week, and Lilia will be there as well as and it's a very diverse group that consists of consumers and providers and advocates in both of our systems.
I'm going to interrupt for a moment. Can you provide us, please, the list of stakeholders that is being engaged?
Yes.
Thank you.
And we will have a discussion with them about whether we should stay the course on some of these programmatic changes in light of the potential of Department of Labor winning. I would also suggest that the legislature consider establishing a contingency fund or a special purpose appropriation for this issue with this amount of uncertainty. I believe the co-chair's budget recommended that funding, and it can be there until we know the results of this litigation. Lily and I can return to you, get back to you quite quickly after our stakeholder meeting to tell you how the stakeholder community is feeling about whether we should stay the course or pause our efforts or do something different.
And the special purpose appropriation or other sort of reserve fund that you might recommend to us, is that at the $35 million level, a $74 million level? Would it include also all of the IT work and extra staffing to if these aren't automated in some way, all the extra people we would need to add permanently for record-keeping systems? Are you proposing much of the startup of that be added into this reserve fund?
Co-Chair Nathanson, at this point I was thinking the additional funding for the programmatic expenditures related to this. Hopefully as session progresses, we're going to have firmer estimates on the administrative impacts associated with these regulations. I can commit to staying in touch with you and keeping you updated on how things are looking in that area, but I'm not at a point where I have confidence that we're going to have certainty on those costs for you quickly.
Okay. Representative Storm.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. On the discussions of the in-home provider, the live-in provider overtime question, obviously I'm caught up on that. Did the discussion include any options of salaried, of having in-home providers be a salaried position at a set amount as opposed to an hourly with overtime for the entire hour of the week?
Co-Chair Nathanson, Representative Stark, that's an excellent question. We considered that. We looked into it. But we determined that the work itself would not have met the definition required for someone to be a salaried employee. And so they're always going to be subject to that hourly pay requirement, and it doesn't look as if that's a solution.
Whose definition of salaried?
It would be under, Madam Co-Chair, it would be the definitions under the Fair Labor Standards Act. They also dictate who's salaried versus hourly paid employment.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
My goodness.
Yeah.
Speechless.
This is not target practice.
We are not upset with you, Mr. McCormick.
I apologize for bringing bad news to you this morning. There's certainly been a tough issue for everyone who's worked on it. All I can commit to you is engaging with continued discussions with you and the stakeholder community on the best way to mitigate the effects of this for both the providers and the consumers alike.
Thank you. And I know that you will be keeping Ms. Byerly updated on the progress of the conversations. You will let co-chair Bates and me know what's going on so we can determine the points in our schedule when we can hear an update from you. I'm recalling some of Senator Winter's comments from earlier in the meeting. It's probably a pretty tough blow to some people who have been so proud of Oregon's work in this area,
yeah,
to keep people in their homes, to demonstrate independence and dignity and compassion, and now to be faced with rules that make it very difficult for us to continue with this type of practice, at least difficult in a budget sense. It's very troubling. We'll hear from you again later in the session.
And Madam Co-Chair, I do plan to actually engage myself in some conversation with our congressional delegation. This is not, it's not where there can't be some kind of intervention. There's been a sea change in Washington, and I think we need to take advantage of that sea change. Some of the things that you're saying that are regulation don't make good common sense. And if it doesn't make good common sense, it may not be something that we want to do. And, you know, in looking at the options, and when you talked about, the 45 hours, you might want to think about, as you talk to stakeholder groups, whether or not a voucher system would be better than the current system that we have. I think you need to look at all variables and all probabilities as we go forward on this. But I do think that our congressional delegation needs to be brought into the loop of where we are and its fiscal impact.
Thank you to everyone on the committee who's been so attentive for today's presentation and conversation. Thank you for bringing us the information. We're adjourned.